This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
What does it take to mete out civil rights justice in the new millennium? Why do so many people feel disempowered and resort to talking about what is wrong instead of taking action to do what is right? What skills must one possess and work trajectories must one consider to avoid activist burnout and sustain a full and balanced life as an effective agent of change? I don't know of anyone more appropriate to answer these questions than the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund's 7th President and Director Counsel, Sherilyn Eiffel. For over 20 years, she served as a professor at the University of Maryland, where in addition to teaching civil procedure, constitutional law, and a variety of seminars, she continued to litigate and consult on a broad and diverse range of civil rights cases while grooming the next generation of civil rights lawyers. A highly regarded and proven national civil rights strategist and public intellectual whose writings, speeches, and media appearances enrich public debate about a range of political and civil rights issues, Sherilyn successfully litigated the landmark Voting Rights Act case, Houston Lawyers Association versus Attorney General of Texas, in which the Supreme Court held that judicial elections are covered by the provisions of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and authored the critically acclaimed book, On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century. It is with more than considerable delight that I welcome Sherilyn Eiffel to the AYG List. Good morning, Sherilyn.
Good morning.
Since you took this post, you barely had a moment to breathe, so I am especially grateful that you are sharing some of your valuable time with me on the AYG List. Welcome.
Thanks so much, April. I'm just happy to be part of it.
Okay, so you moved from being a professor of law for 20 years at the University of Maryland into being the second female president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. I know that it is not lost on you the significance of the connection between Thurgood Marshall and your intellectual institution to the institution that you're now running. Can you tell me how that felt for you in light of that connection to take on the helm of this organization?
Well, in many ways, I took it as confirmation that this was the right move for me. Thurgood Marshall's first successful civil rights case was suing the University of Maryland Law School, where I was privileged to teach for 20 years. Demanding integration in 1935, a case brought in municipal court in Baltimore City and won and affirmed by the Maryland Court of Appeals. And that case really was the first case on the road to Brown. And, you know, I am not originally from Baltimore, but since I moved to Baltimore 25 years ago, really took it on as my home and became very involved and engaged with Baltimore City and also very involved and engaged with the history, the legal history, particularly of civil rights in Maryland. And, you know, I wrote a book about the last two recorded lynchings in Maryland. And so I came to feel in many ways like I knew Thurgood Marshall fairly well because I've read so many of his letters and the correspondence that he engaged in and other members of the NAACP in the 1930s when they were fighting against lynching. I started out at my legal career at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund as a voting rights attorney. So, you know, I've been connected to Marshall and that legacy for a very long time. So it all felt kind of a piece and quite right for me to be going back to the Legal Defense Fund, but going back with 20 years of experience working right in Baltimore City and not just teaching, but, you know, litigating civil rights cases in Maryland.
you cut your teeth on some pretty significant cases in this area, the historic black church in Maryland, as well as that highway that was slated to be built right through the black neighborhood in Eastern Shore. So tell me how those cases taught you and kind of prepared you for what you're doing right now.
Well, it's really interesting. One of the things it taught me, I mean, you talked about the historic graveyard. This is the St. James African Methodist Episcopal Church in Harford County. And I and my students represented residents living around that community or in that community seeking to fight the plans of a developer to build a rubble construction debris landfill right in the heart of that community, right next to the church graveyard. We represented a coalition of African-American and white residents who lived in the area who initially were concerned about their water because they're all on well water. And but also, you know, we then learned that there were African-American Civil War soldiers buried in that graveyard 25 feet from where they planned to excavate for this landfill. And my students got into this research project, and we found that there were at least a dozen African-American Civil War veterans buried in that church graveyard. And I had been used to engaging in, you know, litigation in federal court. I'd had a case in the Supreme Court when I was at the Legal Defense Fund. But what I learned from working on that case with my students for 17 years, we stopped that landfill from being constructed. But, you know, I had to do zoning hearings and administrative hearings and work with applications and petitions to the Department of the Environment, and we obtained, you know, county historic landmark status for the graveyard. You know, we had to do whatever was necessary to provide relief for clients. And so it wasn't just like file your case in federal court and then begin to litigate your way up to the Supreme Court. It was whatever was the forum that was available to stop this landfill was the forum we had to use. And that's something I am bringing back with me to the Legal Defense Fund and have been talking with our lawyers about. It's not about litigating where we're comfortable. It's about going where we can get relief for our clients. And if that's municipal court in Baltimore City or zoning hearings in Harford County, that's what you do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to go back a little bit for listeners and allow them to understand a little bit more about the history and the mission of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and its relationship to the NAACP, because I think people are get a little confused about that.
Yeah, they once were the same organization. It was the NAACP. Thurgood Marshall was the counsel, and it created its own legal defense fund. And under a tremendous amount of pressure, actually, from the federal government around tax status and some internal pressures as well, the organizations decided to split, and they did split, and the legal defense fund was kind of officially, we've been separate organizations for a very, very long time, completely different boards, different fundraising. So we're sister civil rights organizations, just like we regard ourselves as collaborators with other organizations like the National Action Network and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and even the ACLU. So that's kind of our relationship now. We don't have any other kind of intimate relationship. So those are the two organizations. And we're still primarily the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a litigating organization. We're an organization of lawyers. We're a civil rights law organization. The NAACP is a civil rights advocacy organization. It's a membership organization. Right. We don't have membership. If you send in your money to the NAACP, you get your nice card and you're a member. But the Legal Defense Fund, if you send your money to us, and we hope you do, that would be NAACP Legal Defense Fund. You'd make checks out, too. You can go to our website, www.naacpldf.org, naacpldf.org. It goes to support the litigation that we do all over the country. We are the lawyers who litigated the Shelby County voting rights case in the Supreme Court that was just decided, and we continue to represent those voters in Alabama, which we're trying to protect from the fallout from the Supreme Court's decision.
It was not lost on me when you got this position. I said, oh, my goodness, 70 years later, you jumped right into some serious civil rights legal matters that threaten the heart of the work of the organization now in your charge. I mean, from the Supreme Court verdicts on affirmative action and voting rights to the Zimmerman verdict to the stop and frisk policies to the persistence of the school to prison pipeline. I mean, how does this – you go into work every day, and you have some brilliant folks that work for you. Everybody's dedicated. And I'm really happy to hear you say that it's not just about litigating, but all of the things that you have to do on the ground to actually get it there. How in the world did you even think about approaching this work and pulling your team together for this particular historical moment?
The exciting thing, April, is that I actually do feel that at this particular moment, I had something to bring back to LDF. And what I had to bring back is very much what you described. You know, you also know that taking on a kind of public education role, you know, in the media. I did start to do a lot of writing, a lot of op-eds, did a lot of radio, did TV, and wrote my book and spent 5 years researching it, just talking to people about these incidents that happened, these violent racial incidents that happened, and trying to think through the effect of these incidents today. So one of the things I came back to the Legal Defense Fund was the knowledge of how important it is to engage the narrative about race and to be able to talk about it outside the courtroom, to understand that there is a hunger to not have a national conversation like a national town hall meeting, but to be engaged in putting the pieces together, because people have great instincts. You know, they know what's happening, but they can't kind of put it all together. They're going about their daily lives. And we need to take responsibility for helping people understand what's happening, what is the moment that we're in, and for speaking truth to power. So one of the key things has been just keeping a very public conversation going. And I've been, you know, in the media a lot over the last 8 months around voting rights, around affirmative action, around a whole set of issues, just to take responsibility. You know, you don't do it because you want to be on TV. It's exhausting and it's not fun, you know. But you do it because you have to be part of that conversation. You have to engage the public space. And you have to speak for the people you represent. You have to give them a credible voice that's engaged powerfully in setting the terms of the debate about race. So that's one of the key, you know, aspects of the moment that we're in.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I heard your remarks and then I read your remarks at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And you spoke of the need for agitation, mobilization, organization, and litigation in the constant demand for more justice, greater equality, more peace. And I know that so many people of all backgrounds are emboldened and impassioned about wanting to be a part of this movement and wanting to be active agents of change, but feel really, really impotent. And they feel overwhelmed by all of the messages that they're getting and not knowing how to distill them into how they become agents of change. So for everybody, for our white friends, for young people especially, what are you doing with this organization? And I know because I've seen it in your talking points, but what can you say to these people who are like, I want to get in, but I have no idea how to get in?
You know, I think one of the big problems that we have is that people feel disempowered. You know, you correctly diagnose the problem. They don't know how to engage. And sometimes it's almost like giving to, you know, an organization. People feel like if they can't give a big amount of money, you know, they won't give anything.
Right.
But the reality is that everyone has, you know, the most important power that they can possibly have. One is, you know, their vote, and the other is their voice.
Right.
So one is you have to vote. And voting means not just showing up on election day, pulling the lever for somebody, and then walking away and then talking bad about them for the next 4 to 6 years, you know.
It
really does mean keeping yourself informed about the issue, you know, making sure, that, of course, that you vote, but then making sure that you follow up on that vote. And this is the part about the voice. The good news is we're in an age where you can exercise your voice, you know, by the internet, which so many people are connected with. You ought to be emailing your representative. You ought to be emailing your local paper to tell them your views, emailing your local station when you think, you know, that their news story was terrible. This doesn't take a whole lot of time. This is 5 minutes for you to Google their address and send your comment in. If you can't make it to the march, for example, I told you can't make it to the March on Washington, well, that doesn't explain why you haven't called your congressman to tell them that they
need
to fix the Voting Rights Act and these jurisdictions. There is always something that you can do. And finally, I would say, for people who are joiners, I know it's fashionable to critique institutions, but institutions constitute, when they're run effectively, collective power. So find an institution you believe in, whether it's your church, you know, your local community organization, your civic organization, or your party, whatever it is, the campaign, somebody that you believe in. I really believe you should be part of something. You don't have to join seven things. Everyone should say, I'm part of this. I'm part of this union. I'm part of this organization. I'm part of this church, and I'm an active member. I don't do everything, but I do something. Everyone should be contributing in some way. And it actually, when you're doing that, it actually lessens your anxiety, because a lot of us are anxious because we are not doing anything. And so when you don't do anything, you think nothing's happening. But the truth is, a lot's happening. A lot of people are doing. And if more people would do, then they would feel less anxious about where we are, and they would understand it's going to take the mobilization of all of us to move this country forward.
That's a brilliant answer. Recently, our mutual friend and your colleague, Ben Jealous, stepped down as the president of the NAACP. Upon his departure, though, he hinted at his desire to see his successor be a woman. So I wanted to take this time to go back with you a little bit. Did you imagine, as a little girl of Panamanian descent, growing up in your family in Queens as the littlest of 10 siblings, that you would be leading the most significant and effective civil rights organization in the nation?
Well, no. I mean, no, obviously, no. Although I have to tell you, I've always been a big dreamer, you know, and I have never believed, you know, in limitations. But no, actually, what I used to believe was that I was born too late, because I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer from the time I was a little girl, and I felt like I missed the train. You know, I wanted to be part of them, and you know, it's just to me the most enormous blessing that I am part of them now. But that's what I wanted. I thought I just kind of was born too late. But I always believed I would be doing this work. I could always remember, even when I was a kid, because my father was so socially conscious and he was a social worker himself. And we literally had to sit and watch TV whenever there were, you know, significant black leaders on, whenever there were documentaries on about the civil rights movement. And so we were very educated about this when we were young. And I knew I wanted to be part, I knew that that's what I was supposed to do. It doesn't completely surprise me, but it is kind of crazy, frankly.
Right. Well, did you have role models, especially female role models? I mean, I think I know a couple
of
them. Did you find that, you know, as you were growing up, you saw, you know, what you could be through other folks?
Well, thank God for the miracle of television, because, of course, you know, I didn't need a lawyer until I went to law school. So I didn't grow up being able to touch and see with my live eye, you know, what I wanted to be. But I did get to watch television, and I happened to be growing up at a great time, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. I to this day can still remember the day of listening to Barbara Jordan during the Watergate hearings, Congresswoman from Texas.
Right.
And I can remember she had this incredibly powerful voice, and I could see how she was holding the room. She wasn't what I would call a decorative woman. You know, she was a handsome woman, I guess they would say, but she was not, by the prevailing standards of the day, a beauty. She wasn't, you know, that wasn't why she was on TV. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, like, that could happen. I could do that.
Right.
That looks exciting. Right. And this was the same time that Shirley Chisholm was running for president.
Right.
She was from New York and from Brooklyn, also not a decorative woman. I mean, but these women had power. It was the power of their voice. It was the rightness of what they were saying.
Yeah,
and those were powerful examples for me and role models for me when I was very young.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another factor that has come into play in the modern civil rights movement is who should be leading it, or if there should be leadership at all. So I recall when Vangelis got this post that, you know, many folks commented on the color of his skin literally before they looked at his body of work. And the same can be said for Doug Shipman, a white man from rural Arkansas who is now the CEO of the Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta. So I want to talk to you about how we open up this narrative and the workload of this movement to people from all races, classes, and genders, because I think there's a sentiment that it just belongs to the people who are affected by these things, and it's not, you know, for everybody to have a hand in.
I'm so glad you asked this question this way, April, because one of the things I've been saying ever since this, you know, actually before the Supreme Court's decision in the Shelby County case, in the voting rights case, is to try and explain to people that we are in a democracy moment, not a race moment.
Mm.
You know, we're in a moment in which the terms of this democracy are being fought over.
Right.
And that's not, you know, an issue just for black people. We're talking about the future of this country. The same is true with Trayvon Martin's killing. You know, if a teenager who's doing nothing wrong can be stalked and killed, and the person who killed them can get away with it, you know, and can do it with impunity based on their own subjective, irrational feeling of threat, you know, we're saying something very powerful about what it means to just walk on the street as a person in this country.
Right.
So we need to understand, people need to begin to understand that this contested moment that we're in, you know, the moment that we're in Washington where, you know, you basically have the government being held hostage, this is about democracy and the future of this country.
Right.
So, you know, to the extent people, you know, read about the voting rights opinion, they say, oh, my goodness. And people should remember, Freedom Summer was a way of making people in the North understand what the problems in the South had to do with them.
Yes.
You know? And where we are today is in that same moment where people have to understand that this is not just about some Southern jurisdictions and voting changes. This is about the future of democracy in this country.
Yes.
This is about whether we're going to allow some people to vote unfettered, although with what I'm hearing about the voting machines in New York today, it's going to be more widespread than I thought. Three boroughs in New York were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, right? So no longer covered after the Supreme Court's decision. It wasn't just Southern jurisdictions. So, you know, people have to understand that that's the moment. And this is what I mean about, like, helping people make the connections. Because you might be watching this and you might say, oh, you know, talking about civil rights again, and then you might go in the kitchen and start making dinner.
Right.
But no, what we're talking about and what they're talking about is a pivotal moment in democracy in this country in which the terms are being fought over and in which some are trying to shrink and restrict and narrow the reach of our democracy, and others are trying to expand it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to decide which side you're on. And everyone should be on a side on that question.
Right. And everyone is on a side, regardless of whether or not they act.
Yeah, regardless of whether they consciously know they are. Right. You're in action.
Right.
You're in action
if
you want
to
side.
Well, you know, this goes into this powerful notion for me that I wanted to ask you because, you know, I've watched you over the years. You have lent your time and your talent to me as an individual, as a mentor, and I greatly appreciate that. And it occurred to me that one of the major questions that I wanted to ask you for my audience is, regardless of what a person looks like, what kinds of skills does one need to possess to be a successful civil rights leader in the new millennium? I mean, and I say this in the context of the new millennium because there are things that, for those of us who kind of grew up in organizations like the Black Church or the NAACP, we did not have Facebook, we did not have Twitter, we did not have 24-hour news cycles. So the way that we approach this work is remarkably different, and you are in the center, you are in the heart of that right now. So what kind of leadership skills would you suggest people start to sharpen for the new millennium?
Listening. Listening is a great skill.
Yeah.
And a very important one. You know, the whole range of communication skills, because, you know, what we have to understand is the debate over race is ongoing, and sometimes you win, but you always have to go back and refresh and engage. It's such a difficult and tough subject for people to grapple with that you have to be someone who can not only speak, but can listen and can facilitate others to speak. You know, you have to be able to understand how to communicate about race. And sometimes that's just lacking. You know, it's not just about the facts. Just because the facts are on your side doesn't mean that you're communicating effectively. But here's the thing that's, you know, I think even more important, because what you get from that is just a lot of talking heads, you know?
Yes.
You have to actually have something to talk about. You have to do some work on the ground, you know? You have to work with people who are struggling. You have to work giving a voice to the voiceless. You have to have engaged powerful institutions. You have to have worked in some industry. You have to have deeply studied some period in our history. You have to have something to bring to the table. You have to have something that makes your voice one that people should listen to, because there are a lot of people talking now, a lot of people talking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But you've got to have something that contributes to the conversation. And this is what I was saying about coming back to LDF. It's not enough for me to just come back to LDF because, you know, it's great to come back to LDF and lead a great civil rights organization. I felt strongly I had to have something to bring to LDF. That you know, more than I had. I left. When I left, I was a good civil rights lawyer, so it couldn't just be that.
Right.
You know? So I had to have something to bring to it. And that's where the 20 years of experience in a place like Baltimore, not New York, not San Francisco, not Los Angeles, but just a struggling American city, was really important.
You know, I have chills listening to that response because, you know, I watched you, I learned from you, and I took your lead with my own organization. And it was not fun, as you well know. You watched me struggle. You watched me try to do the very work that you just purported that we need to do. And let's be clear, it is not easy, right? So
this
is not necessarily work for the faint of heart. But, you know, the other thing that I want to speak to in this is how does one then build coalitions around this, right? Because you're doing it vis-a-vis a larger organization, but there are some people who are just on the ground who want to be engaged but get frustrated all the time because every time they try to make an inroads, they feel like the door is closing. And I think there's a whole cadre of people who are just like, okay, I'm exhausted and I'm tired and I can't do this anymore. You are the queen of being like, okay, this is how I got over. So I want you to give us a how I got over moment real quick for those of us who are in that place.
This is something we're not good at. I mean, we just do burnout too much.
Yes.
And I have to tell you, one of the reasons that I was able, you know, I left being a civil rights lawyer at the Legal Defense Fund, even though it was my dream job. I left 20 years ago. I had a young child, and I wanted to write. I spent, you know, 5 years just litigating intensely, and I wanted to think about what I had seen. I wanted to say what I wasn't able to say in the courtroom. I mean, I wanted to teach. I wanted to do these things. And what it did was it allowed me to do something else and to live a fairly sane life, to now be back even more deeply into an insane life, you know?
Right.
But here's the thing. You've got to organize your life so that you can take breaks from the intensity.
Yes.
You know, you cannot just do this work until you fall flat on your face, you know, and then go home and just, you know, and be in the garden, you know, for the rest of your life.
Right.
We have to recognize that people can come in and out of this. There are different stages of it. And you have to leave something in the tank for when you're older and wiser so that you can get back in the game. And too often we just, you know, put the pedal to the metal and burn ourselves out. So, you have an organization, you're right, it's not easy. You do your best with it. And then you appropriately decide when I'm going to sunset that, when I'm going to step out of that and do something else. I encourage people, you know, go back to school and learn something. I encourage people to do something as you're doing in media or communications. I encourage people to, you know, do volunteer at an organization or decide that you're going to teach for a few years or whatever is the other thing, because that's part of the curriculum that's preparing you to re-enter the fray in the future. It's not, you know, it's not that you've left. It's that you're gathering different kinds of experiences, but at the same time, you're gathering those experiences in a context that allows you to live and think and recharge. And we just don't do that well, and we have to do it, especially women.
Brilliant. Thank you. Okay. Two last questions for you. The first one is, if you were not an attorney and a law professor, who would you be?
Oh, I would either be a journalist or an actress, one of the two. I was always clear it was going to be one of those three things. Yeah, one of those three. And I always believed that in any of those three, I would be a civil rights activist. I mean, I can remember thinking that when I was graduating from college. It could be I was going to law school, but it could have been any of those three. And I felt like I would be doing what I'm doing through any of those vehicles.
Awesome. And the last question. I know that faith is very important to you. What is your favorite gospel song and why?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I get asked this question. It's really, really hard because I know so many, and I was raised on the old hymns of the church.
I know it's not fair. Knowing you, I know it's not fair.
So I love old hymns. Then there's modern gospel I love. You know, I've talked before about, you know, Shirley Caesar's You Can Make It being a song that has just had incredible restorative powers for me at many points in my life. It's really hard to say. You know, one of my father's favorite songs was My Hope Is Built, and that song is important to me, and What a Friend We Have in Jesus. They're just songs I just, when I hear them, they anchor me, and I love them because they're the songs of my childhood. But, you know, I also love, you know, lots of modern gospel tunes as well. It's hard to pick from among my children. I would just say that music is very sustaining to me and very powerful, a very powerful support for my life.
And I know this. Well, Sherilyn Ifill, focused, fearless, faithful woman warrior, thank you for being my friend, for being my mentor, or for being the first woman. You are the first woman on the AYG list. So thank you so much for offering your time. I know you got to go out there and slay dragons, so do your thing. I'm always praying for you, and I'm always in your corner. And I'm always, always grateful for your witness, not just to women, not just to people of color, but to humanity. Thank you so much for all the gifts that you offer us every day.
Thank you, April. I'm so proud of you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.